Welcome to today's meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us at the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Also know that this program has been underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Kathy Curtis, chair of the Bay Gourmet Forum of the club, and a passionate Francophile besides, and a big fan of Cara Black. It's my great pleasure to introduce Cara, author of the Aimé Le Duc detective series. She is here on the occasion of her latest book, Murder in Passy, and of course to help us celebrate Bastille Day 2001. I would also like to acknowledge the popular blogger Pim of the blog Chez Pim, who is a fellow Francophile and is here and has treated us to her delicious macarons to honor the occasion. Welcome, Pim. Cara's latest book is preceded by 10 others, starting with Murder in Marais, which was published in 1993. Each book is set in a different arrondissement or quartier in Paris. They are set in the 1990s, in the 4 years between 1994 and 1997, to be exact. The protagonist is the charming, tough, and quirky Aimé Le Duc, the owner of a computer security company who continually finds herself solving murders unrelated to her work, much to the chagrin of her partner, the dwarf René. And she's often assisted by her godfather, Morbière, a grumpy but good-intentioned police commissaire. But in Murder in Passy, their relationship is reversed, and she works hard to get him out of a jam, of course involving murder. So, Cara, tell us about Morbière, who is named after a famous French cheese. Is that correct?
That's correct, Kathy.
And why is he so important to Aimé in the series and the Murder in Passy in particular?
Well, as you mentioned, he's Aimé Le Duc's godfather. He was her father's first colleague on the police force, and so they have this long history, this long relationship. But he's always kept secrets from Aimé, specifically about her mother, the American woman who left Aimé when she was 8 years old. But in this story, Morbière is, as you said, the tables are turned, and when Aimé feels that she needs to vindicate him from the charges brought against him, she uncovers layers and she wonders, is he really not guilty? So it's a lot of trust issues for her, I think, in this book. You know, can you really believe this? What if you've known someone all your life? What if things come out that don't quite make sense?
And why did you name him after the French cheese?
Well, I happen to like that cheese, but
we had some here, by the way. I bought it in honor of Morbier.
And well, he is the big cheese, you know. I mean, but he's sort of based on that French actor Philippe Noiret. I'm sure many of you know. I mean, he's in so many films, Il Postino especially, and you know, it does bagging kind of basset hound eyes, and you know, that kind of stain on his tie, and I don't know, that just sort of seemed to fit him, you know, a Morbier, kind of solid, yet with that blue vein kind of running through it.
You know, to me, part of the genius of these books is the fact that you keep this thread of her mother's mystery abandonment throughout. And what I know is you didn't plan to write a series in the beginning. You were writing Murder in Marais based on a wonderful story that of a friend of yours and her grandmother. And how did you know not to disclose all the facts in that? Because you've been able to carry them through the books, and we wait in suspense each book to say, ooh, are we going to find out now?
Well, I didn't know I was writing a series. You know, as you say, I mean, in Murder in the Marais, it was really based on this passion to write about my friend's mother, a hidden Jewish child during the German occupation. But in detective fiction, crime fiction, the detective is usually flawed. There's a wound. And I'm so tired, I'm sorry, of alcoholics, you know? And so people do it very well. So her wound, I thought, would be this mother who she yearns for, who she really remembers vaguely, and who did have an impact on her, and all the secrets, because her father refused to talk about her mother, you know, like she didn't exist. Morbier never reveals anything. Of course, Morbier knew more than he lets on. But so I thought that would be a continual wound. And I think, you know, for an 8-year-old, if you or any age, when you lose your parent, whether to, you know, a traffic fatality or for what, when they're out of your life, it really impacts you. It's
yes, and it really says a lot about her character. You get to know her a lot through that experience that you write about losing her mother, because she's very vulnerable, but she's very tough too, which is, and very, very independent.
Yeah, and tactless, as Renee often points out. She sort of speaks before she thinks.
Now, back to you a little bit. You are not French, and I don't know, I'd love to know what your heritage is, but I know you were raised by a Francophile father who loved food and wine.
Very much so, yes. Yes, and he even planted a little vineyard next to our house, and he really... He loved good food. I mean, he sort of coerced my mother, as you know well, into making these elaborate French meals that my mother would never have done otherwise. But he very much was, you know, he loved food. I remember they went to eat at Le Grand Verfour in Paris, and they had a lunch reservation, which they, you know, gloatingly told me about many, many times, and sat where Colette had sat. You know, there's the name tags there. And my father actually suffered from gout. Pretty rare, right? But that's from...
Isn't that a very French
A very
disease?
French, yes, from yeah. eating and yes.
Oh.
And very much into wine. He was actually one of the founders of the Ravenswood Winery years ago when they would... A bunch of people who were in the... He was part of the wine club here in San Francisco, and they would go up and they would, you know, harvest. They would get grapes from different vineyards and start put it together and melange it or mix it or whatever the term is, and they started Ravenswood like that.
Now, you seem very French to me. I think you're French. You dress French, you talk French, you have an American accent that's sort of French. Where did that all come from?
You know, I went to a French Catholic school in Menlo Park, and we had French nuns, you know, and they taught us French in, it was archaic French, actually, very, you know, old, because their order came over at the turn of the century. So maybe that's sort of where it comes from. And when I first went to Paris in the early 70s, and I was determined to speak French, and I remember I was, you know, I think I went to someone, asked directions, and I started speaking and talking, and finally, the man put his arm on my shoulder, and he said, "You're such an earnest young woman, but you're using words we haven't used since the 1900s. So I knew it was those nuns, you know. And but I realize, you know, now in Paris, 2011, on the street, you know, it's not that kind of language. And the
Do
French.
Do you speak Parisian French now?
I've sort of picked up a lot of the argot, yeah. And when I can't speak, I just do that, you know. Which kind of gets you by there in many a situation.
Right.
But, yeah, and it's also they sort of abbreviate words, too, you know, for... and I'm sure Pim is very well acquainted with about talking about food. It's le fooding, you know. There's a whole trend about, or we're going to do le jogging, you know. It's this...
Le fooding.
Le fooding.
That's new for me. Thank you.
Yeah, you need to know that for your trip.
One of the most enjoyable experiences in your books is the way that you bring the whole sensory experience of Paris into your writing, and you actually feel like you're in Paris, living and breathing it. And so I'm wondering, I know some, I've read about some of your writing techniques, which are fascinating. I like to go in those. But what do? You cook a pot of beef bourguignon and have the smells come in while you're writing, or have a plate of cheese and pâté next to your computer? Or how do you bring in the... How do you do that?
Well, I have a little digital tape recorder, and when I'm on the bus in Paris, I put on the, I record. I record all the sounds. I record the conversations on the bus. I was on this great bus ride for about 40 minutes, and this man was, as we were passing things, he was telling his daughter about where he went to this school when he was young, and then there'd be the whoosh of the air brakes and people getting on and a child crying. So I often record many things, especially in a cafe. You know, where people are bringing in the wine cartons and they're talking with someone and someone. So I want to get the sounds, and on the street, in the sewers, when the water gushes and people, and with those brooms, they're not twig brooms anymore, the plastic brooms, and that whooshing sound. And so when I come home to San Francisco and I'm here in the fog, you know, in my sweats at the computer, I can put the tape, my recorder, and I can go back to that bus ride, to that cafe. More than I could if I, and I do journal, I take notes when I'm in Paris, but it's also hearing that And as you know, the smells, I'm a very, you know, smells are very important to me. So I can't bring those smells back, unfortunately, but I can try to think about them.
Maybe try this cooking up a pot of something French and have it waft into your room where you're writing.
Definitely. I went to the Alamany Farmers Market last week and got some great white peaches. And I was thinking, well, would these sort of be like those Montreuil peaches, you know, the very famous, wonderful peaches from Montreuil just outside Paris? And so I tried to kind of get that mindset. Yes, these could be from Montreuil, and Amy loves those peaches, and, you know, kind of. And I also.
What book did she love those peaches in?
I knew you were going to put me on the spot. I'm going to think about that.
Okay. I'll ask you later.
Okay.
And then tell us some, your techniques are great. Like, you have some old yellow page books from the 1990s that you shipped home or brought home from Paris in suitcases where you can refer to names of shops that were actually there in the 90s. I found that fascinating.
Yes. In 1996, my friend was throwing out her yellow pages and white pages. And I said, what are you doing? I don't need these. No, I want them. So I filled up my suitcase, and I had to buy another one, with the yellow pages and white pages from 1996. So I can refer to them at any time. And the yellow pages are great, because especially for Passy, when I was thinking, well, if someone needed to call a plumber, and you look up plumber, you go to the 16th arrondissement, so you would find a plumber, you know, in your arrondissement where you lived.
Or maybe a cafe was there then and not now. Although I think a lot of cafes have been there for a long time.
Right. You know that film, Last Tango in Paris, remember that? That was filmed in Passy, that apartment.
Oh.
Remember when they were running under the Bir Hakeim, that elevated, that was going into Passy. The cafe at the very beginning of the film, where the woman goes into the restroom, that cafe is still there. And Amy does drop by. It has a different name now. But yeah.
For a quick espresso.
Yes, actually, yes.
Yeah. She keeps moving, that girl.
She does. And of course, I think the windows are all fogged up and steamy because it's raining outside. But very much like that. And also in that film Inception, that was a part of that cafe scene was in the 16th, was in Passy, where it kept being blown up many times in his dream or something. That was in Passy.
And then you visit morgues, and you know police officers, commissaires. Is that what they're called in Paris?
Yes.
And belong to historical societies. And so do you just walk into the police department and say, I'd like to talk to a detective, please? Or
It takes years, actually, Kathy, to make relationships. And so I have been doing this for quite a while. And I take them out to dinner, I ply them with wine, you know, and I say, could this happen? Would this happen? But it's also, as you know, in France, it's about connections. Now, can I show this even though this won't appear on the tape?
Yes, just describe it, if you would.
So I went out drinking with some of the fleeks, the police, and this was the Brigade Criminelle team, who are the elite homicide squad. So we were out drinking, and then they were talking about going shooting. So I said, well, gee, can I come along? So I'm holding up right now a shooting practice figure with bullet holes in it, signed by the members of the Brigade Criminelle. And I fired a Sig Sauer 2022, a 9mm cartridge. Now, I did make all those bullet holes. But
one looks like it's right through the heart.
Yeah. But I was standing like where you are sitting, right here in the front row. They were way in the back, further than where Pim is sitting. I got to go to the police shooting range in Paris. Of course, we did not go the same night we were drinking. We went
Good
another
idea. And you know pretty intimately one of the policemen or detectives that was on the Princess Diana case, right?
I do.
And he's helped you out quite a bit.
He's really helped me out a lot. He's retired now. He's busier than ever. He was in charge of the Brigade Criminelle police investigation of Princess Diana's investigation. And I met him. I would take him out again, you know, drinking and talking. And I often ran ideas by him. But it was one day in 2007, we met at a cafe midday, and he was very rushed and tired, and he sat down, and he only speaks to me in French. And he said to me, "Oh, I'm so tired. You know, I had to speak English for 5 hours." I said, "Why?" "I just got off the Eurostar. I was in London." I said, "You were in London this morning?" "Yes, yes. I was, you know, in this court, and these men had these funny wigs on, you know, and they..." And I said, "Why were you in court?" And he said, "Well, it was the, you know, 10 years. You know, it was the end of the... I had to give my presentation for the investigation." And I said, "What investigation?" "The Princess Diana investigation, you know, 1997 to 2007, and that case that Dori Fayed brought up and all." And I said, "But why were you there?" He said, "But I was in charge of the investigation."
Oh, my.
And I said, "Why didn't I know that?" And he said, "Well, you've never asked me." So there's a lot of things that I know my interviewing skills need to be improved. But, you know, they're you know, you really, they parse their information. So, but once he told me that, I knew that who better to have details about what went on. And so Murder in the Latin Quarter takes place right after her car crash. And there's threads that are woven through. But a lot of times it's by meeting them, sitting down and talking. We go off in another avenue, and then they come up with these amazing details or stories or cases they've worked on.
Sounds like so much fun to me. What a great way to research a book.
Yeah, and I shamefully use it.
Let's talk about Aimé a little bit. I picture her as being super thin, right?
Mm-hmm.
She'd have to be. She wears these leather cat suits and Chanel couture, and she's always pulling on or off leather pants. I mean, you have to be thin to wear leather pants, let's face it. And also, another thing I noticed in the books, she doesn't eat very much. I went through, flipped through three books and found maybe, I don't know, four or five mentions of food. And in Murder in Marais, you get to page 88 before there is a meal eaten. And I think, wait a minute, what was it that she ate? I think it was, she got went to the supermarché and bought a baguette, some chèvre, a local tapenade, and an orangina. And that's what she had. She doesn't fine dine. So tell us a little bit about that. This is my guess, that these books are filled, they're action-packed, and so there's no time to sit down and eat a meal, and it would slow down the story. But us foodies would kind of like to know your opinion on that.
I knew you were going to nail me, Kathy. But let me just say there is mention of macaroons specifically, because I knew she would ask, in Murder in the Palais Royal, and this sort of reflects what Pim said. I'll briefly... her friend says, "You're close to La Durée." Aimé scouted the line coming out of La Durée's Second Empire front door. "They say chocolate macaroons in 15 minutes, corner of Rue Saint-Honoré. Make that an assortment in one of those precious little boxes they have," said Chloe, sounding more awake. Aimé groaned silently. "Done." So she ends up getting a box of assorted flavored macaroons. So there is mention
Very
of food.
Good.
Okay. And there is a gâteau basque mentioned in Murder
I didn't warn her about this question, by the way. I think she anticipated it because this is the Bay Gourmet Forum, after all.
Well, and I have to say I got into a little trouble with the LA Weekly over the mention of gâteau basque. This seemed very controversial in Los Angeles for a brief moment in time, because in this book, a woman is making gâteau basque, and she has made it fresh, right? So Aimé felt something warm being put into her hand, caught the whiff of butter. Inside the blue cloth, tied up parcel-like, she saw the light brown crusted gâteau basque. Okay, so there we have the gâteau basque.
Is that a Murder in Passy?
Murder in Passy.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, now, this is where I got into trouble, because Aimé is holding the gâteau basque and goes to question someone who does not want to let her into the apartment. So she uses her wiles and says, "Is that for me?" interrupted Madame de Boucher, staring at the gâteau basque on top, which was emanating a fragrance of cherries. Aimé saw a way in the door. "Of course, but let me heat it up." Okay. Evidently, that's a no-no. So.
She never cooks, right?
She burns water.
Yeah. Does she have a kitchen?
She has a kitchen.
Okay.
And in Murder in the Ile Saint-Louis, where she finds the infant, and she goes to heat up a hot water, Evian water, to put in the bottle to make the formula, she burns that. She burns it. So she really is not culinary. But often she and Morbier will meet at a cafe. In the Sentier, they often meet and they eat. And she doesn't necessarily finish the meal because something happens right. often. But Morbier is a real foodie. She's also, I think, Murder in Belleville, they sit down at a cafe and start to eat. But he also gets perks. You know, a lot of, you know, if a policeman eats in a restaurant or a cafe, they won't be charged. And that really bothers Aimé. So when that happens, I think in the Sentier that happens. Okay. They were in the restaurant where Jean Jaurès was assassinated. And she gets very offended that he's not even paying for his meal. So,
and her friend Martine, the journalist, is quite the foodie, right? She likes to fine dine.
She likes to fine dine.
Have they ever had a meal together in any of the...
They've been about to?
Yes.
Many a time.
I want to come to back to today and just switch from the book and talk a little bit about Paris and food. Now, I know you travel there at least once a year, right, to do research?
Usually twice a year.
Twice a year. And I've been there many times, and what I've noticed is some of the best food is not French. There are so many wonderful cuisines from all over the world in Paris, and we're so spoiled here that, you know, the food is so good here, so you get a little bit discriminating. Where do you like to eat, and what type of cuisine?
I like street food. I just cringe saying this because Pim is so much more knowledgeable about restaurants and food in Paris, but I do, because I am on the move when I'm there also. But I like the falafels on the, you know, last L apostrophe A-S, it's been written up in the New York Times, that falafel place in Rue de Rosier. I ate there last time a couple of weeks ago. But I will take it and walk and go to the park and eat. I like the those cheap kebab places, the Turkish Greek ones.
Yes.
I like to go in there, and my son and husband quite like, and I can't understand it, a baguette with meat and French fries inside. They love that. There's a name for that, but they just inhale
those.
How
old is your son?
He's now 22. But he will, yeah. But when he was young and I took him to Paris, his big thing was the poulet rôti, you know, the rotisserie chicken that you see in those sort of glass things that are roasting. And he would say, Mama, I want that one, you know. So I would buy him half a roast chicken, and he would, you know, it comes with that wonderful gravy or the juice, and we'd sit in the park, and he would eat his chicken, and he was very happy. Even last time, he said, would you bring one home on the plane, please? I said, I think if I shrink wrap it, it would be too soft, right? By the time we, you know, a couple of 12 hours, you know. But
now, do you cook yourself?
I bake. I can bake. And, you know.
Gâteau Basque type things?
That's a little ambitious for me, Kathy. I know you do. I really like the Gâteau Basque that Angélique, a Basque woman, makes. And they serve it at Fringal. And we've had her gâteau basque. I do a lot of, you know, very peach crumbles, peach crisps. I can do that. Yes.
Now, if you were going to eat and it cost didn't matter at a restaurant in Paris, which one would you choose?
I would have lunch at L'Ambroisie in the Place des Vosges. Pim is nodding. Okay, that's a good choice. I would really like to. I believe there's some kind of champagne tasting that goes along with the lunch, or I would eat there in the Place des Vosges. Then I would have dinner at Le Grand Véfour and sit in Colette's chair like my father did. those are the big. I mean, oh, and then there's this great one in the 11th on Parmentier, Le Grand Bourgeois. I've heard very, very good things about that. And they have a little cousin restaurant that's more affordable for like 25 euros prefix for lunch. So right. I think he's a Basque chef.
Pim, do you mind just shouting out a couple of your favorites? Because I know you're a frequent visitor.
I would have lunch with Tara.
I would too. I want to come.
Yeah.
Lunch at L'Ambroisie.
Yeah.
Oh, no. L'Arpège. I have never been there.
L'Arpège, yes. Oh. So dinner at L'Arpège for your very, very good but expensive meal. And I'm sure with the euro the way it is, it's more than ever right now. You've had quite an honor having two of your books published in French, Murder in the Marais and Murder in the Sentier. I imagine that was quite exciting for you. Because, I mean, just because the way the French are, it seems surprising. So could you tell us how that happened? And
sure. I just want to mention also, if I was just street food, the Marché d'Enfants Rouges in the 3rd arrondissement has reopened, and they have wonderful food stalls, you know, and great in the organic market. So that's a great place to find a different kind of food. It's wonderful. How did it happen? Well, my publisher in New York has French agents and, you know, agents in different countries in the world. And from a wonderful man, Boris Hoffman, who ran this agency, French agency, he was what you'd call a Renaissance man, I would say. He spoke 12 languages. You know, his father had started, they were, I believe, German Jews that had to escape Germany. His father kept the agency going, very literary. I mean, they represented people, very, very famous, and of course the names are escaping me, very respected people. And Boris read Murder in the Marais, and Boris was determined that this would be published in French. It took him 10 years. And he worked it. And I can only say that, you know, this was a labor of love on his part. You know, I really respect that. Unfortunately, he died of a heart attack soon after. And it's, you know, terrible. But I hope I didn't, you know, the process didn't, you know, cause this heart attack. But the agency still represents me. But, I mean, he really believed in this book. And it was really, I felt so wonderful because it is a book that is special to me and that that happened. The second book, Murder in the Sentier, was picked up by a man who's also, he's just written his own book. And he published it, and so I think it was about how would they promote it. And, of course, me being an American and doing book tours in this country, oh, sure, I'll go on a book tour. Sure, I'll go talk to bookstores. That's not quite how we do it here. but I do remember that I gave a talk, I think it was last year, in a small crime bookstore in Paris. And I sort of did the reading half in English, half in French, and my friend helped me. And when I finished, someone said, pas mal, not bad. And no one threw the book across the room?
That's so, a high compliment.
High compliment. I was breathed a sigh of relief when I left, let me tell you. So it was pretty interesting. One of the thrills was seeing my book, you know, in the bookstore in the Marais, Common Roman, which is right near the Enfants Rouges, to see Meurtre dans le Marais in the Marais was just kind of like, wow, you know, an incredible moment. So,
yeah, there was a question here from the audience about how are the Parisians receiving your books?
Pas mal.
Pas mal. let me go to a couple questions from the audience. Oh, and this is back to restaurants. So in the movie Something's Got to Give, remember that scene with, Diane Keaton and her young boyfriend, right?
Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. Where she celebrated her birthday. Do you know which restaurant? Does anyone know?
Yeah, it's right behind the Palais Royal. Le Colbert.
Have you been?
I've walked through it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you haven't eaten there?
No.
Okay. Sorry.
Haven't sold the movie rights.
We can't get you a recommendation, but it looks pretty good. And also from the audience, did you enjoy Midnight in Paris? Have you seen that yet?
Okay. I saw Midnight in Paris when I was in Paris. It was very funny. I kept saying, oh, I'm not going to. But everyone I was meeting in Paris, French and Americans, were saying, you've got to see this movie. So I was staying near Montparnasse, and so there was a cinema on the street. I walked in one night. I thoroughly enjoyed it, but does anyone remember when they hire the detective? They go into Duluc Detective?
Yes, I noticed that.
That's Amy's agency.
I was going to bring that up.
Yes.
Did that come from your book?
Yes. Well,
amazing.
It is the real Duluc detective because you see the sign. They go inside and they speak, and it is the coved window. This is the agency at the same address. But Woody Allen did not ask me permission. So
I think you should write him a letter.
Yes.
Get a little bit of the residuals. Well, what isn't the detective agency in your books based on true women
Duluc.
Run?
Yes. Duluc. Yes. Duluc. It is based on Duluc.
Yeah.
And Madame Duluc's grandfather started it. He had been with the Sûreté. And then her father took it over, and she inherited it, and she runs it with her husband. And she was Madame Duluc, and I mean, she has a married name. But I interviewed her. I based many things, you know, on the detective agency. And when I actually finished the first manuscript, I said, Madame Duluc, can we use your name? And she said, well, we'd really have to read it first. So my editor said, let's just make it Leduc. But it really is based on Duluc, who are quite famous, you know, in Paris.
Back to the character that I love the most, of course, M.A. She has had a few boyfriends, and I know she likes the bad boys. And I love to, you know, it's not, you don't insert that a lot in the books, but when you do, it's very fun and intriguing to read. So there's been Yves, is that and Yves. Guy?
Guy.
Guy.
Guy, the and eye
then,
doctor.
And the murder in Passy, there's a new man.
Melac.
Yeah.
We meet him in Palais Royal. He's in the Brigade Criminelle, and he returns in Passy.
And she was engaged to one. And so talk a little bit about her romantic side.
Her romantic side. Well, yes, she's attracted to bad boys. And I think Martine asks her, I don't know, I can't remember if it's in this book or the next book that you'll see next year. Martine is saying, you know, what is it with you and bad boys? You know, is it this father thing? Is it, and kind of forces Amy to look inside, you know. Why are you always going for the unavailable men, Amy? You know, and she can't really answer that. So, I mean, that is her pattern. And you know, she was raised by men, I have to say that. Raised by her father, her grandfather, who would take her to ballet lessons and pick her up from school. Friday nights, we're at the kitchen table, you know, with a bunch of police playing poker, you know, at night. I mean, and she'd be sitting on their knee and they'd be playing and drinking. So she doesn't really have, you know, she has very different role models and no traditional French family yet. She is traditional in a way as well.
And I have to take note that they never go on dates at restaurants. In fact, I think most of the time when they're together, they're in her apartment.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm determined one of these next books, there's going to be a lot of food references. And
well, work on me. I have a friend who lives in Passy, the 16th arrondissement, which is very chic, very quiet. It's where the maids wear pearls, okay? Not necessarily Amy's hood. And so for 7 years, my friend has been trying to get me to write about Passy. And I said, finally, voila, okay, I did it. So, you know, if you work on me, I will come around. And even Marie, who's in, a librarian who's in the audience, asked me for years to write about the Palais Royal. So, you know, I finally granted her wishes. So, you know, I do.
Good. You know. Pim and I will work on you, right, Pim?
Well, I was thinking that maybe a man that Amy would meet would be, you know, into food and would suggest they take l'escoffier or, you know, cooking classes at the Ritz or something more interesting. I thought
sounds like a good start.
Sounds like a good start.
I had an opportunity to stay in different parts of Paris. In fact, I prefer the less, I call them Americanized parts, like Saint-Germain-des-Prés. You go there, you feel like you're in your New York now. It's unbelievable. There's more Americans than anyone else. And I stayed in the 10th, the Canal District. Absolutely fell in love with it. And now when I go to Paris, that's where I want to go, is those parts of Paris. And I know Belleville. And I think you have the same feelings about Paris. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I'm a member of the 10th Arrondissement Historical Society. I love the 10th Arrondissement. And a good place to eat is La Marine on Quai Valmy. La and then Marine. I really enjoyed that.
Okay. And Le Chateaubriand has a great... I think that's in the 10th.
10th. Yeah, I said Le Grand Bourgeois. It's Le Chateaubriand. Yeah, I think that's the one.
Okay, you just said it differently from me. Yeah. With the right accent.
I like the 10th because it still has the remnants of the working class. you know, and when the canal was much more of a working canal, when the barges really were coming, you know, with salt and, you know, sand for, the, you know, part of Paris. I mean, it was, coming through Belgium and the waterways. And it's still a bit rough on the edges, but it's becoming very bobo, you know, bourgeois bohème. And but you will find these streets. You know, it was a site where there were tanning. It was a leather area, you know, where they would tan the hides, and they have the big, people have made them into these ateliers, into lofts and workspaces. But there is a great feeling about that, and that's what I'm always looking for, that mm-hmm. old Paris. I mean, of course, it's always leaving, as San Francisco is changing as well, but excuse me. But it's that whiff of the past, you know, because Paris is composed of villages. And, you know, the 20 arrondissements, each arrondissement holds 4 quartiers. So people say, how long are you going to keep writing these books? And I go, well, there's 20 arrondissements. And then each arrondissement has 4 quartiers, so I could... But, no, I don't know. But they all have a different flavor. I mean, the Bastille, if we should talk about Bastille, there was a thriving furniture industry. I mean, handmade chairs, tinsmiths who would make mirrors, and you still find that in those small cobbled alleys. You can hear hammers, you know, pounding. And that comes from when the king would put a wall around the villages, and then the next king would knock it down and expand Paris until 1860. It's now the way we know it, with the 20 arrondissements. But especially in Bastille, very much, which goes into the 12th arrondissement, very much mm-hmm. there were convents, and the convents have big land, and they were very wealthy, and the nuns, those nuns again, held a lot of power and wanted the furniture for their convents and a certain way. So they would, hire the furniture makers to make it a certain way, and it had a style. And one of the Louis, I can never remember which one, got very miffed, you know, because that was, he thought, a royal prerogative. So he sort of took that over and decided that these furniture makers had to do it in his style. But there's all this kind of history to that.
Yeah, all the things that you've learned about Paris, it's just incredible.
And those because the Bastille area, the furniture making district, is near the Seine, you know, there's a reason for that. It's because when the barges came down with the wood, they could just go right to the quay and bring the wood up and work right in the workshop, right there.
And I'm sure the canal and the Tenth have some things were shipped down that canal, too, I'm sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, leather would come down and be taken to be tanned.
Now, you say you're a mapaholic, too.
Yes.
So I can just see you walking around Paris with these detailed maps, because you really know. I mean, when you read these books, you feel like you're there, the streets, and you turn the corner, and there's this building and that building. That's quite a bit of detail to know about.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I do. I mean, I have maps. I get maps in Paris. I make my own maps. I diagram where Amy could go, what doorway she would be coming out of, you know, what would be the best route to get to this area. Now, you know, of course, things have changed. Shops have moved, you know, but there could be a deviation. You know, you can always say the road has, you know, is closed, or there's a detour. A metro station could be closed briefly. Certain exits would be closed. But I really walk that. I climb in that sewer. I go in that cavern. I have been in that, I think it's in Latin Quarter, where they go underground in the quarry and see the film in that cavern. I have been there.
Yeah.
I have crawled there.
Didn't the National Geographic just write about those quarries and people have parties down there? And yeah, have you been down
That's
there?
Where, yes, I have. Yeah. That's the February issue. It's great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my friend who does maps for the category, he is acknowledged in that as well. Yes, I've been down there. We had to squeeze through a little hole, and we have to wear boots, and it's not, you know.
Ooh, that'd be a great place for a murder.
I think so. Yeah. No, I'd love to do that, because it's also where you come out from. You know, I was going with these cataphiles who go underground, and we're walking down a boulevard. There's a manhole cover. He's got a crowbar up his sleeve, literally. Puts it in there, lifts it up, and we go down the manhole.
What is your favorite quartier?
I love them all. I have to say I'm very partial to the Marais. the third, and the fourth. My next book is set in the third, which is the northern part of the Marais.
What will it be called?
It'll be called Murder at the Lantern Rouge, set in the smallest and oldest Chinatown in Paris, and there's four Chinatowns in Paris. So it's very unique. I like Batignolles in the 17th arrondissement. There's very much a village feeling there, if you haven't been there. And
no,
there's a great bakery right in front of the church. And I kill someone is murdered in that phone cabin that is still there. That is in front. You'll find it by the phone cabin, the murder, and the bakery. Really
okay,
good bakery.
So the 17th is up Paris, right about here?
Well, it's very long and very big. The nice part is near the Champs-Élysées, Arc de Triomphe.
Okay.
And then the area, the other end, is the train yards up towards Montmartre. So it kind of goes Place des Ternes, Parc Monceau. So it's got a very chic side and a bit seedier side.
I meant to bring a map of the arrondissement. I kicked myself.
Oh,
I could have been pointing and knowing where we're talking about. Speaking of the Marais, what was it like when you first started writing your book? It's changed a lot, right? It's very chic. There are very expensive shops. What was it like in 1993?
Run down. Very run down. I mean, it's so odd to go on the weekends now because they close it down. Parts of it is pedestrian streets. And it's just a sea of heads. It's very different. But it was very run down. When I got to know it, it was the 80s when I first went there. I mean, the buildings were sagging and falling apart. I look at the buildings now, and it was like, oh, this was about on its last, last legs, especially near the Swedish Cultural Institute. That they've remodeled that building. It's incredible. It was very different. There were cobblers. There were shopkeepers. There were people who had their small shops, the bakery, and they lived there. They still live there. And
what was the Picasso Museum in those days?
It was just kind of abandoned, I think. I don't think it was, or it was owned and maybe owned and vacant. Mm-hmm. A lot of these buildings were vacant. It was too expensive to put in heating and plumbing. A lot of them had no plumbing, even in the 80s, a lot of these buildings that are now all redone.
Right.
Very prohibitive to do that. But it was very much of, this was a quartier, this was a village, the people that had their shops and lived there, the people, it was very much a community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people are gone. What used to be the cobblers is a tanning salon or something,
Right, right.
very,
couple questions from the audience. In the book before Murder in Passy, Aimé almost goes to New York.
Yes. Yes.
Are you intending to have her leave Paris at any point in time?
I don't think Aimé will be leaving Paris, but someone else might.
Oh, is this in the next book?
It might be in the next book. They might be coming to Zilacon Valley. But I can't say.
Okay. There's a book. Oh, and yes, there are books to be bought after the program. Another question from the audience. Since you weren't planning to write a series, what made you decide to continue?
What made me decide to continue? Well, when my editor in New York called me and said, we're going to buy this book, and I said, fine. And she said, well, where's Aimé going next? And I said, excuse me? Yeah, what's happening with Eve, and what about this, and where will she be going? And I said, she said, well, you are writing a series, aren't you? And I went, of course I am. And I ran to the computer, and I realized she was feeding me ideas, and this is sort of... It's been very fresh for me because, as you brought up earlier, I didn't know what was happening with Aimé's mother. I still don't really know. I'm uncovering and finding out with Aimé. But it's really been an exploration with her. This is really 4 years in her life that we're kind of going through. And, of course, we're at the most dramatic parts, because that's what fiction is. We don't want to really read about the boring parts, when she's eating or anything.
Oh, shame on you.
Oh, I'll be stoned, yes. I didn't mean that.
Perfect. You got me. Okay, and do you have any plans to write a novel outside of your current series?
Yes, I do. Thinking about a historical fiction.
Have you started it yet?
I might have, yep.
Oh, being very secretive. Now, a couple of audience members want to know if your books will ever be a PBS series on Masterpiece Mystery.
I would like to know, too.
How can we make that happen?
Anybody know anyone? Rebecca Eden? Whatever she is. You know, I know that this Sunday there's a new series starting, Aurelio Zen, great one set in Italy. He travels around Italy. Great, Michael Dibden, who's sadly passed, great series set in Italy. And everybody has been emailing me the same question. Why aren't you on there? Because this is showing a different side of Italy. You know, the gritty side, the police corruption, as well as the beautiful side. I think we should start an email campaign. I don't know. I would love something of that quality. Yes, I would. And thank you for that question. I would love, what, you know, I think it's the summer of Paris, I have to say, because the Midnight in Paris has come out. Many books about Paris have come out, you know. It's all about Paris.
And it's like, Americans are in love with Paris, let's face it. They always will be.
And why don't we?
It's Henry James days, yes. Right?
And why don't we go more often in a film? Why does it have to be only Woody who, you know? I mean, you know, there's so many wonderful, it's so cinematic.
He did such a beautiful job with the scenery in Paris in the beginning of that movie. Oh, yeah. It's just gorgeous. We've come to the time in the program for just a couple more questions. If anybody in the audience has any, at this point you could stand up and ask. This is your chance. Go ahead. Good question. Just to repeat the question, why did Cara decide to set the time period in the 90s and not currently?
I began writing the book and going off into Paris in 1993. And I really knew that time. It also took me 3.5 years to write that book and to sell the book. But it was also a time that I really felt I was being reacquainted with Paris, and there was so much going on. So much of what is happening today resonates with what began in the 90s. You know, Jacques Chirac gave that famous speech, 1995, finally acknowledging, yes, France collaborated with the Vichy government 50 years after the war. I mean, no one had said anything before. This was a fissure in the wall of silence that has opened very, very largely now. So there was so much going on then. You know, they were rioting out in the suburbs, burning cars, mm-hmm. at that time. But CNN didn't get there till 10 years later, okay? But this was all, what we're seeing now was happening then, and that's just a time I got to know. And just, especially for Marais, where we have people who were survivors of the Holocaust and World War II, they couldn't be too aged, you know, or they'd be in walkers. So I've just sort of kept that, I've just kept this episodic in Amy's life. I like the fact that they still pay in francs. You can smoke in the cafes, and Amy uses dial-up. There's no Google. She can't Facebook or tweet.
Do you think she would be a Twitter or a Facebook user? You think?
Renee would, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
But I think that's a real challenge for people writing, setting their story today, of all the modern technology.
Yeah.
And the minute your book comes out, you're already a year behind, you know, technology-wise. So I kind of like the fact that we may move on, but I like paying in francs. I just...
Yeah. And so did they, right?
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead. Gentleman right here.
How did you construct Amy's character? Is it based on a real person? Is it a composite of other people? Or just how did you arrive there?
How is Amy composed of? She is a composite of several women I know. I interviewed 3 female detectives in the 90s who owned their own detective agency, and they're quite different. They're kind of out of not the traditional mold, you know, which I think detectives are. And I took bits and pieces. I wanted to know how a detective agency was run. I have a friend who's very stylish and, you know, has that careless kind of tousled chic look, and wanted to take some of that. And I knew I couldn't write as a French woman because I've got a scarf issue, but I do my best. We know it's genetic, but...
You mean you don't know how to tie... You're doing okay.
Well, you know, with careful observation after many years, But I feel it's really important. I mean, you know, I can't write as a French woman, but having her being half French and half American, and just trying to pull someone who is a contemporary Parisienne who has issues with men, because even the most chic women, I mean, do have, you know, man trouble as anywhere. It's kind of heartening, actually, when you think about it. But you know, a contemporary young woman dealing with Paris today, running her own business, you know, kind of having a dog to walk on the cape. We haven't talked about Miles Davis very much.
No, we haven't. Let's talk about him for a bit. Definitely.
Yes. She has issues because she has trouble even getting him to the groomers, you know, so her domestic side is not
awesome. And the dog is a Bichon...
Bichon
frisé, yeah.
Miles Davis.
Yes. Oh, the question is, which book would Cara recommend to begin with? And that is a good question. Can you read, do you have to read them consecutively, or can you just drop in anytime you want to?
I write them to stand alone, so that if you're in an airport, you pick up the book, you can get it, and you can get who she is, her background, what's going on. Because, I mean, I think that really has to be that way. That said, a lot of people like to start at the beginning. But I do write them to stand alone, so that you can pick up Pussy and be right there and, you know. Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, I love the latest book because I hope that's my, you know, I hope I'm improving with each book. It would be the best writing. I like Pussy a lot because in it, Amy goes into I don't know if anyone's ever noticed, but in each of my books, she goes into a museum. A scene is set in a museum. Nobody's, you know, for maybe some brief thing. I mean, because there's so many wonderful and different museums in Paris. She goes into the Maison de Balzac, the Balzac Museum, in his house, which I did. And there's a lot of reflection she has about Balzac as a writer and about the 50 cups of coffee he drank a day.
Yes.
And seeing his actual coffee pot and how he escaped from his creditors out the back door and using Pussy as this sort of suburban place. I really love Balzac, and because Balzac was that Parisian writer, I mean, writing about Paris and Zola, you know, writing about Les Halles, the belly of Paris, I mean, and Victor Hugo, you know, I mean, it's really about, there are the very rich in Paris, and there are still the people who were jailed for taking a piece of bread, you know, I mean, there's still that inequality, and I kind of revere that. I don't know if that answered your question, but
my personal favorites are Murder in Passy and also the first one, Murder in Marais. I think everybody should read that one. You'll absolutely love it. And I just want to make a quick announcement that books will be sold after the program. We have Murder in Passy, but you can find Cara's books all over the Bay Area in small bookstores as well as the biggies and online. And so I'm so sad to see this end. This has been so much fun to talk to you, Cara. And thank you to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our radio audience. And this program of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.